on the one hand, you have to be living and breathing and being human in your approach to any kind of Shakespeare. And these sonnets were not meant to be acted. They were meant to be read. So it's tricky to make a sonnet seem very spontaneous in a way because they're so structured. But in the plays, you should never notice as an audience member that poetry is being spoken. On the other hand, it is verse. And I believe in honoring the verse when there's verse versus when there's prose. There should be a difference. And while the audience shouldn't be aware of it, the actor should be aware of it. And there are different rules to follow whether you're in verse or prose. And I think it's something to aspire to, that it is an art form, and it's something that we should reach for and make beautiful rather than just turn into ordinary language. It's subtle, and it's beautiful to me.
Welcome to The State of Shakespeare. I'm Jim Elliott.
I'm Garrett Vandermeer.
And our guest today is...
Charles Tuttle.
Hi, Charles. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Can you just share a little bit of your bio with us?
Sure. I was an actor for about 15 years. My career really began professionally when I was lucky enough to work with Tadashi Suzuki on his production of King Lear, or as it was called, The Tale of Lear. And this was the largest co-production in the history of the not-for-profit movement. I began teaching about 10 years ago, and now I am primarily a teacher at acting conservatories, SUNY Purchase and the Atlantic Theater Acting School. And I do a lot of coaching for people to get into graduate schools, and I coach people when they're in production.
So you've chosen to talk about Sonnet 128.
I have. I like the sonnets because they are very succinct and they have a very particular order and structure to them. And I like this sonnet because it's not so simple. Some of them are quite direct and clear, and this one has some language in it that is worth exploring, I think. And so I thought I'd spend the day looking at that.
I love it.
Well, where do we begin with a sonnet? Sonnet 128.
Well, I think with any sonnet, you want to start with the fact that it is 14 lines. It follows a particular rhyme scheme, which is ABAB, CDCD, EFEF, GG, meaning that there are three quatrains and a rhyming couplet. In other words, there's alternating rhymes and then a rhyming couplet at the end. That's how I'd begin talking about a sonnet. I'm sure you've probably covered this, but Shakespeare wrote in iambic pentameter, meaning that there is an unstressed syllable followed by a stressed syllable, and there are five of those feet per line.
That's actually a good jumping off point, because Shakespeare likes to play with that meter.
He does, and we'll see in the sonnet that there are reversals of that particular structure. If the entire play was strictly iambic, it would put the audience to sleep. So one of the things that we want to look for is, where are there deviations from that rhythm? Because where that is changing, that's a place where a listener should sit up, or where the character is undergoing some sort of shift from the norm. So we have to understand how the norm gets established, and then what is the syncopation to that rhythm.
That's terrific. I noticed a couple of those syncopations in this particular sonnet. Do you want to talk about perhaps line five?
Sure. Line five is interesting. I mean, perhaps I should just say the line.
Yeah.
It is written, "Do I envy those jacks that nimble leap?" And so the iambic pentameter of that line would really purely read, "Do I envy those jacks that nimble leap?" That's troublesome. Probably in Shakespeare's day, the word envy could have been pronounced envy, maintaining the purity of the structure of that line. But I think in a contemporary reading of the line, we really have to say, "Do I envy those jacks that nimble leap?"
It would be wonderful if you would read the sonnet that you have selected for us.
I think it is a good idea. Sonnet 128. How oft, when thou my music playest, upon that blessed wood whose motion sounds, with thy sweet fingers, when thou gently swayest the wiry concord that my ear confounds, do I envy those jacks that nimble leap to kiss the tender inward of thy hand, whilst my poor lips, what should that harvest reap, at the wood's boldness by thee blushing stand? To be so tickled, they would change their state and situation with those dancing chips, or whom thy fingers walk with gentle gait, making dead wood more blessed than living lips. Since saucy jacks so happy are in this, give them thy fingers, me thy lips to kiss.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You made it.
I did, but I'm not particularly happy with my reading of it, which is good.
Where is one likely to encounter a sonnet today?
I love on my first day of teaching to let the students read the first meeting between Romeo and Juliet. And I always ask them if they notice anything about the structure of that particular meeting. And it takes them a little while, but eventually they see that those two characters have an exchange, a scene, in fact, that adds up to a sonnet. And we can talk about how intelligent those characters are by the way that they are able to pick up on, and it's particularly Juliet in that instance, who is able to take Romeo's offerings and she can hit it back and pick up on his rhyme. And between the two of them, they also create a sonnet. They kiss, and then they begin another sonnet, which gets interrupted.
That's fascinating.
Like Ginger Rogers, she does everything that Romeo does, only
backwards and in heels.
Let's return to the sonnet for a second and talk about another line that might be funky in terms of the meter.
Well, I would talk about line 12, making dead wood more blessed than living lips. As long as we're talking about iambic pentameter, purely iambic would be making dead wood more blessed than living lips. And of course, we would never say making. So toward the end of the sonnet, Shakespeare has taken that first foot and he has reversed the rhythm of that first foot and he has turned it into a trochee, meaning a stressed syllable followed by an unstressed syllable. So there is a nice little turn there.
There's a rhetorical device at play in line 12. The thesis, which is set up by the word dead, is matched by the antithesis of the word living. So when you encounter a foot where the thesis appears in what would normally be the unstressed position, how do you handle that?
Well, dead does have to be operative because it is being compared with living. It's interesting. I'm questioning, and this is how I would work on it. And I like the fact that this is coming up because it makes me question certain things. So make is stressed, ing is unstressed, dead is stressed. The question is wood stressed or not stressed? And I think I would probably say it is unstressed. So it's a trochee followed by a trochee. In my personal opinion, I'd have to scan the rest of the line to really answer that, to make sure that we have five stresses in that line. But the reason why I want to suggest that wood is not stressed is because it's already on the table. Wood has appeared earlier in the sonnet, and so I would make the argument that we don't need to stress it now because it's already in the air. You know, I think blessed is important, so making dead wood more blessed than living lips, or making dead wood more blessed than living lips. So I stressed more the first time, I unstressed it in the second. And you have to be careful because you can't stress too many words or it gets confusing to the listener.
What difference does it make? Like how, you know, an actor just starting out comes and starts doing his due diligence with scansion, and then what do they do with that?
Well, I think ultimately, the most important thing is to be clear. You want to be able to communicate clearly. So the scansion is there to help you be clear about what is trying to be communicated. The scansion is there to make a point. And if you are comparing dead and living, for instance, the scansion will help you be clear about what that is. So maybe we should talk a little bit about the images that are
Absolutely.
In the sonnet.
Let's talk about the challenges that we have in reading it.
I think the first one is that that first sentence is 8 lines, and that there are a lot of images in those 8 lines. And this is one of the things that's most wonderful and challenging about teaching this, is that in contemporary experience, we tend to speak in very short sentences, or we're texting these days as a way of expressing ourselves. And so to keep all of those images going in one sentence is very unusual.
It's gorgeous, and it seems so unusual to turn our attention on these parts of our paramour's body. Suddenly, the most erogenous part of her is the palm of her hand.
Mm. Well, it's a very sensitive part of the body, and of course, yeah, it could be very erotic to be touched by that part of the hand. I do want to just talk about one little thing, which is that often in Shakespeare, characters talk about wanting to be an object, you know, wanting to transform themselves into an object, or using a metaphor as a way of communicating. And I like it when characters use metaphors, because it means that language has failed, and that we can't communicate something in a very contemporary or colloquial way, and we need to use a metaphor in order to express what's going on inside. We know that Romeo says to Juliet, "Oh, that I were a glove upon that hand, that I might touch that cheek." So that idea of, I wish I could be, you know, that object, so that I could get to be able to experience what her hand is doing to her cheek.
I think we still do that today.
I think we do it in unusual situations. Well, we say, oh, it's like blah, blah, blah,
right.
Or it's as if I did this.
Right.
And those are ways of...
Yeah, absolutely. It's just not as perhaps poetic or artfully done, but it is. I think it's still in existence today. We can't communicate exactly what we want, so we use a metaphor or we substitute.
I like the idea that these characters are not able to express themselves well, and that is why they were able to come up with particular language, or where there is a series of words in order to try to articulate something. You know, we often see a repetition of language in yeah. order to try to express something.
Reputation, reputation, reputation.
Yes, and in that case, it's a word that's being repeated, but I'm also interested in words where there is a development of an idea and where the language is changing, but somehow that character is not able to express something, and so uses a different word, and uses a different word, and uses a different word, and then finally lands on the word that is able to articulate the idea. And this is what is interesting when it comes to the structure of verse versus prose, and why a character might change a tactic at the end of a verse line in order to try to articulate what is coming next, if that makes sense.
It's a beautiful way of thinking about metaphor, to imagine it as being not florid or superfluous to the intent of the character, but rather indispensable and essential to communicating the thought.
Well, that's what we're trying to do, right? We're trying to get to how the character is thinking and how the character is trying to express that thought. And of course, every day, I just did it just now, where I like changed my mind in the middle of an idea. And so the question is, where are the characters either changing their mind or shifting their tactics to try to get to what it is that they are trying to get done?
Which leads us right back to scansion, which scansion is clues into that.
Yes.
Yeah. Hey, so let's talk just technically for a second.
Sure.
One of the questions we ask a lot here on the State of Shakespeare is, are you a versist or a punctuationalist?
I'm a versist. And I'm newly so. In the last 5 years or so, I have become that. I think probably in my actor training, I was told to go for sense, and that was primary. And for many years, I would just try to be clear about what I was trying to do. And consequently, I would often turn the verse into prose. In other words, I wouldn't honor the verse line ending because it wasn't important to me, because my own feelings were more important. In the last few years, and I suppose this comes with age and experience, that I think it's harder to honor the verse, and that there's something very subtle about trying to find the truth of the verse, and that that is something that I would want to aspire to. But I wouldn't say that you should honor the verse at the expense of the moment-to-moment reality between the characters.
You're not the only person who said that. I believe that Margaret Robinson said that. So, to go back to a long sentence, because I think it's a really good thing. I know you're trying to avoid it, but I'm not going to make you do it. You don't actually have to try to do it. But here's my question. Versus meaning that you're going to breathe at the end of every line. What about the punctuation?
Well, the punctuation is not Shakespeare's. The punctuation is an editor's. And you could look at many different versions of Shakespeare text, and the editors have gone to sources, either the quarto or the folio, and have decided where the punctuation should go. And that is interpretive. And they are making an artistic choice about how to be clear with the text. So, I mean, if I were acting something, I would probably take the punctuation out and see if I could come up with my own version of what the punctuation should be.
That brings up a huge issue, which would be exciting to explore, which is about, well, if there is no authoritative version of Shakespeare, how much leniency do you allow yourself as an artist to take with it? How much liberty do you take? Is there a limit? And if there were an authoritative version of Shakespeare, would we care 400 years later?
Well, I think, I don't know, I would like to think we should care. I guess what I would say, if it were me, I would go to every source that I could, and I would look at what many editors and what many scholars have said about what the reality is inside of the text. You know, what is going on here, or what should be going on here, and what is the truth of what's being said here? And I would examine what these experts have come to in terms of what is this meaning. I like to sort of cite The Tempest in this regard, because in The Tempest there is a city that we now know as Milan in the play, that's referred to in the play, and that word actually scans as Milan in The Tempest. So the question is, do you honor that scansion, or do you try to make it clear to your audience about what it is that you're talking about? But something does get lost. Rhythmically, it gets lost. Well, it's just like in this sonnet, do I and vi. You have that little rhyme with I and vi. And so that gets lost. Do I and vi those jacks gets lost when you turn it into do I envy those jacks. So what's artful about it gets reduced to something that is ordinary. And I do think, and listen, this comes with being middle-aged, that all of a sudden I become more sensitive to what the potential is, and I wish that people would aim for that potential. I mean, I can remember being younger and not caring about that. So it's something happens over time where you see the subtlety of something and you think, well, that should be respected. The thing is that I guess there are choices that get made. And the question is, what can you bring out of this, and how can you communicate what is going on in these words? It is possible to bring out all of the sexual innuendo, I suppose, but is that what's really meant to be going on here? I don't know.
Right.
It could just be somebody that is longing and who refers to, you know, when the speaker says, since saucy jacks so happy are in this, you know, to call somebody saucy is to basically say that they are being very sexual and that the keys are being sexual. I guess I wonder, is that holding that sauciness up in a beautiful and elevated way, or is it condemning them as being saucy and saying they should, you know, they should not be doing this?
And I think for me, I think this gets to, reduces it to, in a good way, to why we're doing this, which is in order to know that those choices are there, you have to be able to do what we're talking about. You have to be able to delve in and understand the words and understand the scansion so that you can see all the different choices. And then to go back to what you guys were talking about, it becomes, which direction do you choose to go in?
And you can't do it all. I mean, this is why scholars and theater makers are always at odds with each other, because the scholars see so much, and of course the playing of it can never live up to what they understand about the plays. But that's theater making. You have to make it seem like this is happening for the first time.
One quick question, because I think we do have to wrap up.
Yeah, it sounds like The Radiator is making a statement about that.
Yeah.
The state of Shakespeare.
Yes, a statement. Just quickly, when you first started out, I mean, well, let me not say that. Let me say that, can you look at a piece of text and do you scan it in your head, or do you have to sit down and do the hard work of scanning?
Oh, I have to sit down and do the hard work of scanning, and I would mark it. I mean, I would literally take the text and I would scan it. And I make my students do that. And I also make them look up every single word and define, well, not every single word. I make them look up the operative words and define them all. Because language has changed since the plays were written. I was fortunate enough to work with a coach a couple of years ago, and I was working on a piece of text from Measure for Measure, and the line was, it was a piece of text of Angelus from Measure for Measure that is, when I would pray and think, I think and pray to several subjects. And the gentleman I was working with said, what does the word several mean? And I said, 3 to 5. And he said, you need to look that word up. And several actually means separate. So you can't take anything for granted. So Angelo says, when I would pray and think, I think and pray to several subjects. Separate subjects.
Right.
So the most ordinary word needs to be defined.
If the opportunity arises, would you come back?
Certainly.
And where are you going until May?
I'm teaching from day until night.
So sometime after May?
Sure. Yeah. No, I mean, I could do it. Yeah, I'd be happy to do it a number of times with a bunch of different pieces of text. I would love to look at, like, a little piece of, say, Two Gentlemen of Verona versus Winter's Tale. Just how that language is drastically different, midline endings and things like that. Because he got more sophisticated, and it made the acting more naturalistic. Because he wasn't working with this kind of structure, and he was putting midline endings, the breaks that were happening were occurring more often than they were when you were playing through a whole line. So it made the acting more real.
We talked at great length with Ellen Adair about midline endings.
So she was working Helena, All's Well That Ends Well, and there's a big one in there.
Then I confess here on my knee before I have an anew. What did she say about I adore the sun? That's always tricky for me.
She actually had a very good little bit on I adore the sun, because it was...
Because there's a double meaning,
yeah,
of course.
Yeah, she was talking about the double meaning. Sun and this.
Right.
And, but there was something even more that she brought to it. Do you remember, Garrett?
She talked about the monosyllables.
Yes, that's
I
always important.
Love
your son. Yeah, it's so important that you really separate those out.
Yeah.
You can do that once in a speech, and that's it. But you want to identify where those monosyllables are.
And then she
It's funny, too. I'm sorry, but in that speech, too, it's interesting, because she says, then I confess here on my knee before high heaven and you that next unto high heaven, right? She goes through all of these things. She's avoiding, 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 right? Until she gets to, okay, I'm going to do it. Because there's been all that game playing before.
Yeah.
You know, I'm your mother. No, you're not my mother. Because if you're my mother, then I'd be marrying my brother, and I can't do that, right? They go through all of those shenanigans.
And she and Ellen Adair addressed that. It was great.
It's wonderful how these interviews dovetail, and I think that it gives us wonderful opportunities for editing. We may have a little bit of Charles Tuthill in the Ellen Adair.
So thank you.
Thanks, Charles.
My pleasure.
Thanks for joining us for the State of Shakespeare podcast. We invite you to visit stateofshakespeare.com for more episodes, information about each of our guests, and the Shakespeare text you heard on the program, and much more. And we welcome you to join the discussion by liking us on Facebook. That's www.stateofshakespeare.com. Thanks for listening.